The eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to Him. We're on a journey through biblical history in search of people God can use because we're asking God for a renewal in our church, and we want to be the kind of people that God wants to work with and wants to work through. Starting with Abraham, we move through the Exodus, the period of the judges, the long reign of the kings. And today we move into the challenging period of the exile. After centuries of warning, the Lord brought severe chastisement upon His people. He punished their idolatry and their pride by giving them into the hand of Babylon for 70 years. Around 600 BC, Babylon defeated Egypt in a monumental battle. And a few years later, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon attacked Israel. Really didn't do a whole lot. He just kind of marched there and asserted his dominance. He didn't want to destroy the place. He just wanted their allegiance. And to encourage compliance, he conscripted, he took hostage a number of prominent Jewish leaders' children. And his intent was to indoctrinate them and make them the future leaders of Israel. Israel, of course, resisted Babylonian rule, so he came back. He leveled the place. He defeated and sacked Jerusalem. The Babylonians kept their huge empire together by forging new leaders for their conquered nations from their own children. They forced these young men to get used to Babylonian religion, dress, food, language, and at the same time catered to them with such opulent advantages that they got quite used to it, enjoying the privileges of royal favor. In other words, he turned local sons into Babylonians. Now, the book of Daniel records the adventures of four young men, led by Daniel, who were among those taken hostage just before the fall of Jerusalem. Sprinkled within the book are some of the most remarkable prophecies ever recorded. But our interest today is on the narrative portions that describe what happened to these young men as they were groomed for service in the Babylonian government. And what we learn is that God uses people who remain faithful to Him by resisting the pressure of their culture to conform. We're going to read from Daniel chapter 1, starting in verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel the name Belshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now, God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, "I'm afraid that my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink, why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would have my head because of you." And Daniel then said to the guard, whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar put these young Jewish men in a vice, and then he turned the screw. His purpose was to squeeze the Jewishness out of them and to squeeze Babylonian culture into them, so they would be thoroughly Babylonian in outlook and in loyalty as they became the future representatives of the Jewish people. And this vice had two sides to it, a carrot and a stick. On the side of the stick was pain, coercion, and the constant threat of death. These boys or these young men had been wrenched from their parents, their families, and their homes that they would never see again. They were marched hundreds of miles on foot. They were mutilated. They were made eunuchs. Any of their friends who would not cooperate were summarily executed before their eyes. The book of Daniel records numerous incidents when questioning Babylonian authority would mean instant death. On the other side was the carrot of privilege, the best clothing, the best living conditions, the best education money could buy, a fabulous career track with almost unlimited potential of advancement in the greatest superpower in the world. If one perk kind of symbolized all these privileges, it was the royal food and wine that's mentioned in verses 5 and 8. It was mentioned a couple of weeks ago to us that eating at the royal table was a big deal in the ancient world. Now, it didn't necessarily mean you always ate in the king's presence, but it meant that you ate the same food he ate. You ate from the same kitchen. And this food and this drink represented the entire opulent and privileged lifestyle that was provided by the king as a gracious gift. And the purpose of all this privilege was to develop and ensure special loyalty. Think of access to special seating on Air Force One or a personal limo with the presidential seal. A comment that's made later in Daniel 11 underscores that those who eat at the king's table were expected to be the most loyal of all of his subjects. Well, of course, eating the rich variety of delicacies provided by the king would mean that these Jewish teens would have to set aside the Old Testament dietary laws. The Lord had specified that certain animals were not to be eaten by his people. Jesus would later lay aside those laws, but in Daniel's day, they were still in force. And Nebuchadnezzar's program required that he would lay aside that part of his Jewish heritage and beliefs. It says in verse 8 that Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself in that way. Daniel drew a line that he wouldn't cross. And we're going to see that he and his friends would draw such lines at other points, very important points in their lives as well. This is the first one. He made a decision in his own heart about what faithfulness to God would demand of him. He recognized that decision might cost him his privileged position. It might even cost him his own life. But you know, some things are worth dying for. And for Daniel, this was one of them. Two factors enabled Daniel to survive this line in the sand. First, you note that God intervened in the life of a very important unbeliever to show favor and sympathy to Daniel. A person doesn't have to be a believer for God to nudge their hearts in a certain direction. And Daniel's resistance to cultural pressure did not lead to death because God intervened at the appropriate time and place with the appropriate people. Notice that Daniel's obedience was not dependent on God's intervention to help, however. And you know that because of the way the whole story develops. I mean, remember it later when his three friends were commanded to bow down to this big idol of the king, and they said, "We're not going to do it." And the king said, "I'm going to throw you into this furnace." And they said, "Nebuchadnezzar, if we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it and rescue us from your hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, king, that we're not going to serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you've set up." Daniel and his friends were prepared to draw lines which they would not cross to compromise their faith, whether God intervened or not. Not even if it meant death. But of course, God did intervene. And he did that repeatedly throughout the book of Daniel. The other factor bringing success was that Daniel found a win-win solution to this standoff. The sympathetic chief of staff would be happy to comply with Daniel's wishes about food, but he was afraid that being a vegetarian would cause the young man's health to suffer. That would mean his head. So Daniel said this famous test, "Just give us 10 days on vegetables, let's see what happens." And of course, they looked great, their complexion was good, everything was wonderful. So the rich food, avoiding it, didn't hurt them at all. The chief of staff was happy to change their diet. Now these examples from Daniel provide rich instruction for all Christians. Christianity is rooted in the history of Israel. But the part of Israel's history the New Testament most identifies with when it comes to the church as a whole is the exile. Both James and Peter speak of the church as the diaspora, the people of God dispersed. James calls the church the 12 tribes scattered among the nations. When Peter writes to the church, he addresses his letter to strangers in the world scattered throughout the Roman provinces. When Christianity has a powerful influence on a nation, as, for example, it's had in the United States, it's tempting for the church to identify with Israel during its period of conquest. And Christians speak of taking over the land and controlling the government and routing the forces of godliness. And surely, when most people in a democracy actually have a biblical worldview, the impact of Christianity is profound and pervasive. But when the worldview of citizens in a democracy changes, then we need to remember that we really are still strangers and aliens amidst a world in spiritual rebellion. And the book of Daniel becomes once again extremely important for us to look at. Not because it teaches us exactly what choices to make. Our world is not Babylon, and the carrots and sticks we face are different. And we certainly are not living under Old Testament regulations. But Daniel reminds us that we have to draw the line somewhere as our culture continually works to assimilate us. The question is not whether we draw a line, deciding where we will or will not bow to cultural pressure. The question is where we draw it, and do we have courage to do so? Remaining faithful to God against the pressure of culture requires a lot of wisdom to do successfully. You have to know what is worth dying for and what isn't. You have to know how to construct win-win scenarios as often as possible and ask God to work in the hearts of the people you're working with. As you read through the book of Daniel, it's very interesting to see how he picks his battles. I find it fascinating. We're told in this very text, they gave him the name Belshazzar. That's the name of a Babylonian idol. Daniel accepted it. He thought that was not worth dying for, and it didn't impact his loyalty to God. They also made him a magi, a court astrologer, and some kind of a scientist and general wise man. So Daniel would study their science, and he would study all their superstitions, became an expert in them, because he didn't think resistance was worth dying for, and it didn't compromise his loyalty to God. In fact, as you read on, you find out he becomes the chief of the wise men and left a lasting impression on that guild. Daniel not only served a pagan king, he served him so well that he was the most talented and trusted advisor the king had. He was given national stature. He was entrusted with great power. He was one of the very, very few people, actually, in all history, to ever bridge administrations. He bridged the Babylonian and Persian administrations when Persia defeated Babylon. He was so good that the Persians kept him on. Daniel was extremely successful in a pagan nation, yet he was also extremely faithful to God. He's known in the scriptures as a faithful servant of the Lord. And Daniel encourages us that with God's wisdom and God's help, we can successfully negotiate the compromises demanded of us, because we're going to face the same pressure to conform in our world as he did. We're going to have to compromise in areas that are going to make us personally uncomfortable, because God's people are strangers and aliens in this world's culture. But we also have to draw the line effectively, wisely, to define where we're not going to compromise, whether God intervenes to help us or not, but with hope that God will intervene to give us success and that he'll give us wisdom to construct win-win scenarios that allow us to remain faithful to him and satisfy the interests of our culture at the same time. This text isn't going to give us specific answers to our challenges, but what it gives us is a magnificent example that highlights what drawing the lines are all about. Why did Daniel draw the line with dietary regulations? Why that? Not with the pagan name he was given, not with his career in astrology. Why did he risk his life over dietary laws? The reason has to do with the Old Testament's purpose for distinguishing between the clean and the unclean, including the dietary regulations. The basic reason for those laws had nothing to do with health concerns. They were consistent with health concerns, but that's not why they were given. The Old Testament has lots of ceremonial laws, and all of them had symbolic rather than literal significance. Now, the Old Testament moral laws, like the Ten Commandments, they reflect God's character. They're always expressions of his holy will for us. But the ceremonial laws were temporary. They were symbolic regulations to illustrate a point. We know that's true because when Jesus fulfilled their symbolism, he ended them all. He didn't end the Ten Commandments, but he ended the dietary laws because they were symbolic. What did the dietary distinctions mean? What did they signify? What they did was they created habits that encouraged God's people to think about what they took into themselves from the outside. You've heard the expression, you are what you eat. Not only is that obviously true with respect to food, but it's also true with respect to ideas and customs and habits and cultural practices. God wanted his people to be morally, ethically, spiritually distinct from all the other people in the world. So every time, I mean literally every time an Israelite opened his mouth to eat, God wanted him to think about what went in. And that gesture with respect to food would help them do the same thing with respect to everything else when they consider all the nations around them. Later, Jesus would explain to us that food doesn't really literally make you imbibe the sin of the world. He said, don't you know that nothing that enters a man from the outside can make him unclean? It doesn't go into his heart, it goes into his stomach. And in saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. He went on, what comes out of a man makes him unclean. But the Old Testament was a time for simple, almost childlike regulations that made a spiritual point that even today we can go back and learn from. Trapped in a foreign pagan culture, Daniel needed that simple reminder. He needed it every day. Every time Daniel would eat a meal for the rest of his life, he wanted to remember that he had to think about every piece of Babylonian culture put on his plate. And he had to decide what he could stomach and what he couldn't. What he could break down and digest harmlessly, and what would weaken and poison his soul. And since the dietary laws brought that issue to the forefront every single day, he chose to draw the line there. It was both very practical and a very symbolic decision that he needed to make right at the very beginning of his career there to maintain his own spiritual integrity. Now later, these Jewish men were going to draw the line out in the open as a witness for all the world. Think of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the fiery furnace. Think of Daniel facing the lion's den in order to keep his own prayer life focused on the Lord and make sure that the king and God were put in the proper order, okay? But it starts here with a line that's drawn rather quietly, almost in private, very quiet, a line for his own soul. He needed to keep those dietary laws because they would help him remain faithful in every other challenge he would face. Now, I am one of those who think that there was a change in American culture last week. Now, we just went through a very hotly contested election. There's a lot of strong feelings. I understand that. Regardless of who you voted for, I hope you think carefully about what I'm going to say. I think last week represented what might be called a tipping point after decades and decades of change underneath the surface. Many people believe that the election was decided by a poor economy, and I certainly wouldn't argue that, but the change represented by the election was, in my view, only accelerated by a bad economy, and I don't expect things to go back to where they were anytime soon. Not until a worldview changes and take a revival for that. We've become a nation firmly devoted to pluralism rather than to one single outlook of our Christian heritage. We have become a majority of minorities, where diversity of outlooks, ideas, and lifestyles are all welcome and all equally welcome. Conservatives, including many evangelicals, may not like that change, but the change is upon us. We have called the shots for a long time in elections and in a lot of other ways. We're used to having our take on Christianity as being the dominant cultural force. But I don't have to tell you that a variety of cultural forces have pushed the evangelical Christian outlook aside for a long time. This past election was just one event, but I think I see it as a milestone in our country's cultural journey, a tipping point, if you will. Evangelicals are still very, very powerful. But it is finally time for us to recognize that we have become one minority among many. not just because of the last election, of course, but the election brings that evolving fact into an unmistakable focus for us. And I suggest that it's time for Christians, therefore, to stop looking at America as the promised land to be taken by force, as if we were living in the days of Israel's conquest. When the Bible uses that kind of language with us today, it has to do with us. We're the ones being conquered. There's a battle going on in our own soul, we're told, with the Holy Spirit and our old nature. That's where the conquest language comes in. But otherwise, I think it's more appropriate for us as a church, as a whole church, to identify with Israel's exile. I believe the scriptures teach we have been in exile since Pentecost. Ever since God's people lost a homeland and became an international community called the church, we have been a nation of aliens living in other people's countries. We don't have a country. And that's going to remain true until Jesus Christ returns. When we were in cultural dominance because we dominated a worldview, we might have forgotten that fact. But now I think it's time for us to remember that we are resident aliens in a world that is foreign to our faith. And you know something? That doesn't scare me one bit, not even a little. Because the good news from the book of Daniel is we can prosper in such a culture. We can prosper very well, thank you. Thankfully, we are not looking at religious persecution here. We live in a remarkable democracy in which our religious rights are valued. And that is why, by the way, the most important political involvement we can pursue is working to maintain our national religious freedoms. And I am so happy that one of our own members has founded the Institutional Religious Freedom Alliance. And I think that Stanley has targeted the key political issue of our day, one that transcends party lines. Both Republicans and Democrats have an interest in preserving religious freedom against those who would force their point of view on anyone who's in the minority. And as long as we can exercise our religious freedom and our freedom of speech, this new age in America can be a tremendous opportunity for the church to prosper. Daniel not only prospered personally, he may have been instrumental in the conversion of no less than Nebuchadnezzar himself. And he left a heritage that spanned centuries, a heritage that moved three distant disciples centuries later to follow a star toward a manger in Bethlehem. Over his lifetime, Daniel was trusted by radically different administrations, usually led by kings who didn't share his faith. And with such influence, we can only guess at the good that he brought into their cultures. We Christians can prosper in a pluralistic society if we have the wisdom and we have the courage to draw the line against our own compromise, to maintain our own identity of who we are and our faithfulness to God, and to do that in the right places and to do that in the right ways. I suggest that the church exercise questionable wisdom in this regard throughout the spiritual decline of the 20th century. First, the line was drawn with the movie industry, and we abandoned one of the most potent technologies ever invented. And then the line was drawn over styles of music and length of hair and card playing and other peripheral activities. And none of those lines in the sand were particularly effective, either in maintaining our own spiritual integrity or passing on the faith to our children or effectively demonstrating our faith to the culture at large. And somewhere along the way, we drifted from focusing on lines that limit our own compromise to lines that were limiting the behavior of others. Not that there's anything wrong in us trying to influence godly legislation, far from that. But I think we took our eye off the ball of keeping ourselves faithful to God first. For example, we've tried very, very hard to legally limit the scourge of abortion to save precious unborn lives. But at the very same time, we've lost our ability to create a distinctive and compelling Christian heritage for our own children. And I know that because nationwide, they're leaving the church in droves. We've tried so hard to legally define marriage according to gender the way God does. But at the same time, we've lost our ability to create distinctive and compelling Christian marriages so that we're just as much in needless debt. And our time is just as much structured by the world, and we have just as much heartache and disappointment and divorce as the culture at large. In a culture where pressure to conform is only going to get worse. We need to learn something from Daniel about how to resist that pressure and negotiate it, not only surviving, but thriving. We're going to see the two sides of the vice. We're going to experience both of them. We're going to experience the stick that intimidates us to conform. There are potential consequences when we draw a line that defines our faithfulness. Because you can't limit drawing that line just to where it's safe. Like Daniel, we too must determine the critical issues that will enable us to remain faithful and resolve not to defile ourselves, no matter what happens. When you draw a line, you may face consequences from your neighbors or from your employer or even from your family. And on the other side is the carrot, seducing us to conform, the very real promise of success if we just put aside our faithfulness to eat at the royal table. You know, all the classic professions these days are becoming a little uncomfortable for Christians because professions always have their written and their unwritten rules, things you must do, things you must not do, things you must say, things you must never say. And in a pluralistic world, any strong viewpoint, including ours, is going to be pressed to conform to the way the world finds least offensive. And your progress in a profession may be compromised by your faith. Education holds the key to most good jobs, and you will be graded according to the prevailing worldview. And absolutely every Christian is going to be tested big time in this and every culture to their obedience to the fourth commandment, keeping the Sabbath holy, because that is one commandment God said he put there so that we could be distinct. Daniel shows us that we have some hard decisions coming down the road. I do. And so do you. The challenge that's facing us today is perfectly illustrated by those old Jewish dietary laws. What can we take in and digest without harm? And what would make us spiritually sick? Our culture has many voices that don't love our Lord, and they're going to do their best to try to conform us to their way of thinking. But the Bible calls us, it says, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And the good news is we can prosper tremendously in such a setting. The nation's health is one thing, but our spiritual health does not depend on our controlling the nation's legislation. Our spiritual health has much more to do with controlling ourselves and cultivating integrity and a lifestyle that is built around being faithful to our Lord. So to review, this text teaches us at least three things about how to cultivate such faithfulness. And I hope you'll talk about these things now and down the road. Number one, let's choose where we draw the lines carefully. There may be consequences, and so let's choose potential conflicts where they are really worth the effort. Let's choose lines of personal integrity which will strategically help us be faithful across the board. Number two, let's ask God to help us. Let's ask God to help us. Let's determine ahead of time to live with the consequences of being faithful no matter what, no matter what, but let's ask God to help us out. And when necessary, to give sympathy and compassion to the people we need to help us, even when they don't believe in him at all. And number three, let's look for win-win scenarios. Let's determine how our decisions to remain faithful to Christ is good for everybody. Not through argument alone, but by creatively illustrating with undeniable clarity the blessings of a biblical way of life. As long as we have freedom in this country, we should expect to do very well. We should expect to experience God's power as we intelligently, graciously, and courageously resist conforming to our culture. Because the eyes of the Lord range throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him.